The book of Judges, really in the early part. Last week we had chapter, actually 2 weeks ago, we had chapter 4, verses 1 through 11. And just remember the overall theme here is how the people of Israel become like the nations around them, become like the Canaanites. So what the author wants us to do, his purpose in telling the stories that are here, is that he wants to wake up his own generation to what's going on and how they are becoming like the nations around them, and to urge them to repent and to follow the Lord, lest they become like Israel and did when they became like the Canaanites and Sodom and Gomorrah and descended into worse and worse conditions. So, relevance today. Is there any example of Christians, churches, church people becoming like the culture around us? There's probably no better example. Just think about this right now. What is most of our culture doing right now? What is most of the church in America doing right now? Likely the same thing, right? Likely the same thing. So I ask those questions from a guy who loves football, but realizes that that's all part of it, right? That this is what is going on and this is how it works. This is how we become like the nations around us. So most of the Judges is composed of stories about these people who are deliverers of Israel, six of them. There are others as well, but that's most of it. We are in this one tonight, the story of Deborah, or Deborah and Barak is the English Standard Version puts it. It's chapters 4 and 5. And so chapter 4, if you remember, is a narrative. It's the story of what happened. And then chapter 5 is poetry. It's the song, which covers the same story, but different parts of it and with a different perspective. So remember that there's this repeating cycle. The Lord raised up so-and-so to save Israel. It starts out with the people of Israel did evil in the eyes of the Lord, which means they started to worship other gods, the gods of the people around them. And so the Lord sells them into the hand of oppressors. The people cry for help. The Lord hears them. He raises up a deliverer. And then the land has rest for 40 years. The story of Deborah has some variations to that. For example, the fourth one. Never in this story does it say the Lord raised up Deborah or anyone else to deliver Israel. So we should always keep this cycle in mind, though, as we go through Judges, because it happens over and over again. Once you get to number five, you go back to number one. This is another way to look at this story in particular, this story that we're on tonight, which covers all of chapter 4. Kenneth Way, in his commentary, had pointed this chiasm out. It's called a chiasm, the way that it's lined up there. You have A and A on the bottom. They match up pretty well. I'm fully convinced that that's the way this text is constructed and meant to be understood. And so you can see that in this structure that there's a parallel between A and A and B and B and C and C. And it's an easy way to remember stories, and it's an easy way to teach stories, because this would have been carried down orally for some time before the author writes it down. So this is a last time, then, we went through these first three, which was 2 weeks ago. So since it was 2 weeks ago, again, here are some of the highlights from from that section. And the people of Israel again did what was evil in the eyes of the Lord. Again, that means they worshipped other gods. And the Lord sold them into the hand of Yavin, the king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. And then Yavin's commander, his general for his army, is a guy named Sisera. And he is one of the main characters in this story. Another one is Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidot. And she was judging Israel at this time. And she sent and summoned Barak, the son of Abinoam, from Kadesh Naphtali. And she said to him, so he's the general of the people of Israel at this time. And Deborah calls him and says, has not the Lord, the God of Israel, commanded you to go gather your men at Mount Tabor, taking 10,000 from the people of Naphtali and people of Zebulun? And I will draw out, that's the Lord saying, I will draw out Sisera, the general of Yavin's army, to meet you by the river Kishon with his chariots and his troops, and I will give him into your hand. It's got a question mark there. It means certainly the Lord has done that. The Lord has done that, and Barak said to her, if you will go with me, I'll go. But if you will not go with me, I will not go. So it's not enough for Barak at this time that the Lord promises to be with him and promises to give up all the enemies into his hands. He still says, I need you to go with me. And she says, fine, I'll go. No, surely I will go. Nevertheless, the road on which you are going will not lead to your glory, for the Lord will sell Sisera into the hand of a woman. And so much of the rest of the chapter is how this all plays out. How is this all going to turn out? You've got Deborah and Barak. The Lord's commanded to do this. So who is the one who is supposed to be the deliverer? You've got Deborah, she's the judge. So she's one of the judges, one of the deliverers. You've got Barak, he's the head of the army. Who is going to carry out this duty? And then we ended the time with this, and I mentioned it last time, that this verse seems to be disconnected from the rest of the story when you look at it right here. You're talking about this interaction between Deborah and Barak. And all of a sudden, inserted, you have this. Just seems out of the blue. It says this. Now, Heber, the Kenite, had separated from the Kenites, the descendants of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, and had pitched his tent as far away as the oak of Zanamim, which is near Kadesh. It's like a random piece of information, it seems like. And last time I compared it to a piece of a puzzle, that it seemed to be just one lone piece and it didn't mean much by itself. But with the rest of the pieces of the puzzle, it becomes like a masterpiece. And the puzzle wouldn't be complete without this piece. So this is a masterpiece of how God works and how he works out his purposes for the good of his people through things that seem like insignificant pieces of information to us or insignificant events to us. So we didn't have the time to talk about the other pieces of the puzzle last time, so we're going to start with those tonight. So we'll pick up in verse 11 where we left off, and we'll go through the rest of the chapter then. And we'll have to move fairly quickly as we go through. So the tent of Heber. Now Heber, the Kenite, had separated from the Kenites, the descendants of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, and had pitched his tent as far away as the oak in Zananim. So we have something expected here that showed up. So who was Heber? Well, here's who he was. He's from the tribe or the people of the Kenites, the descendants of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses. So we're going to do a real quick, a few references really quick to try to kind of put some of these pieces to the puzzle together. Because Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, why is he showing up here now? Well, let's look at Exodus 18. I'm just going to read verse 1. So you can, I'll keep that on the screen so you can hear the difference. Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, heard of all that God had done for Moses and for Israel, his people, and how the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. That's Exodus 18. One, so notice a different name there for the father-in-law of Moses. He had at least two names. Jethro, and he plays a major part in Exodus 18. And so here he is. He's an important part of that story. But then he doesn't disappear, but he shows up again later. This is in the book of Numbers. So Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers. In verse 29, it says this. And Moses said to Hobab, the son of Reuel, the Midianite, Moses' father-in-law. Hobab was the father-in-law. We are setting out for the place to which the Lord said, I will give it to you. So Moses is talking to his father-in-law. It interrupts what else is going on as Israel's preparing to head out to the promised land. It's doing what everybody else is preparing. And then you have this little story here about Moses is talking to his father-in-law, inserted, it seems like, in the middle of it, just like what we have in Judges. But it tells us more. It says, we're setting out for the place which of which the Lord said, I will give it to you. Come with us, and we will do good to you, for the Lord has promised good to Israel. But he said to him, so Hobab answers back, I won't go. I'm not going with you. I will depart to my own land, to my kindred. And he said, this is Moses now, please don't leave us, for you know where we should camp in the wilderness, and you will serve as eyes for us. And if you do go with us, whatever good the Lord will do to us, the same will we do for you. So they set out. So you get that? He didn't want to go with him. Hobab didn't want, he wanted to go home. But Moses convinces him, no, we want you to go with us. Please come with us. So he convinces him, and he goes. And then earlier in Judges chapter 1, the next reference. Judges chapter 1 says this in verse 16. Again, this seems to be inserted into the middle of a story. It's the story that that Caleb gives his daughter in marriage to Othniel, and then gives him some springs, gives him some land and some springs of water. And then, just almost right out of the blue in verse 16, the next thing. And the descendants of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law, went up with the people of Judah from the city of palms to the wilderness of Judah, which lies in the Negev near Arad. That's in southern Israel. So the Kenites settle with Judah, with the tribe of Judah. All these people, Moses' father-in-law's descendants, settle in southern Israel. And they become part of the tribe of Judah. They're not Jews. They're not Israelites. They're just part, they associate with them. And then our verse today. Now Heber the Kenite had separated from the Kenites and had pitched his tent as far away as the oak of Zananim, which is near Kadesh. So he separates from the clan. He's there because he doesn't want to be part of the clan anymore. He's kind of like an independent guy or something. But he moves far away. He moves into northern Israel, near Galilee, where it just so happens he's in the vicinity of Mount Tabor, where Barak is supposed to assemble the troops to fight against Yavin and Sisera. That's where he happens to pitch his tent. All these random things that seem to be unconnected in the stories they're in fit together to put him right in the place where God uses him in that place to change the course of history, basically. He's there by seemingly things that could have gone either way all the way along, and he is there. They're random pieces of things that all fit into God's masterpiece of his taking care of his people. God causes all things. We ended with that last time. What's in all things? All things to work together for good. All things over centuries here to work together for, in this little story right here. So this is probably a good place to pause and say, so what is this story about that we're in right here? So I was working on this when we were in Mexico last week, and I had with me this notebook that I carry and write things on when I have to teach or preach in other places. And in it, this story reminded me of where we were in this story, reminded me of something that happened on November 30th, 2019, when Brenda and I were in Gambela, Ethiopia. And the church there, a Presbyterian church that we were working with, asked me to preach the next day. Okay, so I said, yes, I will do that. Had a text in mind, got it prepared. I think it was 8 or 9 o'clock at night. David Jahl, if you guys know him, so he was with us, came up and said, well, the church said that all the Presbyterian churches preach on the same text every week. So here are the texts you have to preach on. I said, can we vary from that? And they won't let you. You are preaching on Ezekiel 9, 3 to 11, 2 Peter 2, 4 to 9, and Luke 12, 35 to 40, which I'd never preached on any of them before. And by the way, this is tomorrow morning. So the great thing was that by putting them all together and just thinking about them for a little while, you could go, okay, here's the point. God knows how to rescue the godly people. That's the point in these texts. God knows how to rescue, and it's actually stated in 2 Peter. God knows how to rescue the godly from temptation. Something like that is it. But God knows how to rescue his people. That's what this story is about. He knows how to do it. The theme of the judges, again, the canonization of Israel. The other theme is God has compassion and delivers people, his own people, his undeserving people. They don't deserve to be saved. They don't deserve to be rescued. God knows how to rescue them. And if there is no deliverer, there's not one mentioned here, God knows how to do it himself. And God does that himself. And it's in this central part of the story that the Lord routs. It's the Lord who routs Sisera's army. So we'll go through, we'll read through this. So this story, God uses people you wouldn't expect him to use. Started off with using a woman judge, which you would not expect. You have a military commander who's too scared to act without a woman with him. And then you have a woman that's completely acting on her own, it seems, perhaps with no thought of the Lord at all. The Lord is God. He knows how to rescue his people. So we'll read through this section, and then we'll just point out a few things as we usually do. When Sisera was told that Barak, the son of Abinoam, Noam, had gone up to Mount Tabor, Sisera, called out all his chariots, 900 chariots of iron, and all the men who were with him from Haroshet Hagoyim to the river of Kishon. And Deborah said to Barak, "Up! For this is the day which the Lord has given Sisera into your hand. Does not the Lord go out before you?" So Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him. And the Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and all his army before Barak by the edge of the sword. And Sisera got down from his chariot and fled away on foot. And Barak pursued the chariots and the army to Haroshet Hagoyim, and all the army of Sisera fell by the edge of the sword, and not a man was left. So go verse by verse. When Sisera was told. So the ESV version, which we have up on the screen, turns this verb, the verb that's there, into a passive verb. Was told. When Sisera was told. A better translation would be this. When they told Sisera. Which naturally brings up the question, who are they? When they told Sisera. So commentators have suggestions. Maybe he's got spies out. It's a good suggestion. Or maybe it's Heber and his family. And that's the one that makes the most sense to me, because in light of the previous verse where they're located near this place, and in a verse that's coming up, we're going to see Heber and Yavin, the king of the Canaanites, are probably allies. Sisera called out his chariots, 900 chariots of iron, and all the men who were with him from Haroshet Hagoyim to the river Kishon. Iron chariots. They were the superpower of that time. So Israel, if you remember, was afraid to go against iron chariots. And now they have somebody with them. And he is there to take on Barak. But the Lord had promised, if you remember, to draw out Sisera, his chariots, and his men, and give them into Barak's hand. He had already promised that he was going to do that, and he promised to do it at the river Kishon. So look what Sisera does. He's playing right into Barak's hand. Really, he's playing into the Lord's hand. So notice how the sovereignty of God works. God says, I'm going to draw him out with all his men, all his chariots. I'm going to draw him out for you, and it's going to happen by this river. And Sisera, on his own, says, let's get all our chariots and our horses together and go to this river. Exactly as God said it would happen, that he would make it happen. So God's making it happen. God's doing it. He's drawing him out. And Sisera's doing it on his own, by his own command. And Deborah said to Barak, so Deborah, the prophetess, judge says to Barak, commands Barak, the military commander. Again, who's supposed to be the deliverer here? Deborah said to Barak, up, for this is the day in which the Lord has given Sisera into your hand. Does not the Lord go out before you? And then we get, we might expect this. Why didn't he say this? We might have expected him to say this. I will go down with my men if you'll go with me. But if you won't go with me, I won't go. That's what he said last time. What's different this time? He says, or it says, Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following me. He does exactly what he's told to do this time. Last time he wouldn't do it. So Barak is kind of a mixed bag here in his faith, right? He won't go without Deborah earlier, but now when he's actually facing the army, he goes. He's a mixed bag. You wonder how that works. But aren't we all that way? Isn't that the way that all of our faiths are? Have you ever beaten yourself up for not acting out of faith when you were sure you knew exactly what the Lord wanted you to do? Or worse, beat up other people for their lack of faith. And then we have this. So what should we do if we realize that we've been acting with a lack of faith? We haven't had enough faith. Maybe imperfect faith, maybe very little, maybe like in Jesus says, oh, you have little faith. I have almost none. So what do we do about that? Well, there's only one thing to do, and that's trust and obey this time. Let's start this time. We can't go back and fix our lack of faith before. I don't know Matt Barak's motivation, but that's what he did here. He had a lack of faith before, and now he just acts. So what does God think of faith like that? Faith that fails and then acts. We can think of other examples. Peter. What does God think of faith like Peter's? Denies Jesus and then comes back. And Jesus says, you know, when this is all over, you're going to help your brothers. You're going to guide them along. So Barak doesn't obey the first time he's told, and he doesn't obey right away. But here he does. So here's Hebrews chapter 11. If you know Hebrews chapter 11, if you know what it is, some people call it the Hall of Faith. Abraham's in here. Noah's in here. Sarah's in here. Abel's in here. And in verse 32, and what more shall I say? For time would fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David and Samuel, the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, enforced justice, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, and were made strong out of weakness. Became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. That's what God thinks. Looking at the story here with Barak, you can say, well, that's, I can kind of see that now. When you get into some of the others mentioned here, you might go, I'm not so sure I can see that. But you can see it. And the Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and all his army before Barak by the edge of the sword. So Block says that this verse is the key to understanding the chapter. The Lord routed Sisera. What does that mean? The Lord routed Sisera and his chariots and his army. Other than saying it happened before Barak with the edge of the sword, the text doesn't really tell us how he did it. Doesn't tell us how the Lord did this. Actually, we do get to find out, though, in the song portion of this next time. Tells us more about it. But the Lord uses people, and the Lord can use himself. The Lord can do anything all by himself. So whenever we see a situation that looks hopeless, like 900 chariots of iron, impossible odds, trust, obey, faith. God knows how to rescue his people. He knows how to do that. Again, Barak did not have perfect faith. And here he just acts against impossible odds. And maybe he knew that God knows how to rescue his people. And Sisera got down from his chariot and fled on foot. He may have been a strong military commander, but in defeat, he completely fails. And Barak pursued the chariots and the army to Harosheth Hagoyim. So Sisera had fled from his men, right, while Barak was pursuing the chariots, and they were headed for Sisera's home. That's where he's from. He's from Harosheth Hagoyim. Sisera runs away from home. And all the army of Sisera fell by the edge of the sword. Not a man was left. Not one of them was left. But Sisera escapes the slaughter. He ran the other way. And don't forget, remember that Deborah prophesied this. The road on which you are going to Barak will not lead to your glory, for the Lord will sell Sisera into the hand of a woman. The tent of the wife of Heber. But Sisera fled away on foot to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. For there was peace between Yavin and the king of Hatzor and the house of Heber the Kenite. But Sisera fled away on foot to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. Again, away from where the chariots were, the other direction. His home was west from here. He went east. Why would, though, Sisera flee to her? For there was peace between Yavin, the king of Hatzor. So his boss, the king, there was peace between them and the house of Heber, the Kenite. So Sisera was Yavin's general. Yavin was the one that the Lord sold, whom the Lord sold Israel into. Peace in this sense probably means there was a treaty, that they were allies. So the Kenites, the other Kenites, were allies of Judah. But Heber had separated from his people and became a friend of the Canaanites who Israel left around. So Heber and Jael are apparently thought of themselves something like we would say today as sovereign citizens. I do what I want when I want. I don't care. We're separatists. We don't care what the rest of our tribe is doing, what the rest of our people are doing, what the rest of our structured government really is doing. We do what we want. And so we separate and we go way up here by ourselves right into this battle. So Jael acts on her own. And Jael came out to meet Sisera and said to him, "Turn aside, my lord, turn aside to me. Do not be afraid." So he turned aside to her into the tent, and she covered him with a rug. And he said to her, "Please give me a little water to drink, for I am thirsty." So she opened a skin of milk and gave him a drink and covered him. And he said to her, "Stand at the opening of the tent and say, 'If any man comes and asks you, is anyone here?' say no." But Jael, the wife of Heber, took a tent peg and took a hammer in her hand. Then she went softly to him and drove the peg into his temple until it went down into the ground while he was lying fast asleep from weariness. So he died. And behold, as Barak was pursuing Sisera, Jael went out to meet him and said to him, "Come, and I will show you the man whom you are seeking." So he went into her tent, and there lay Sisera dead with the tent peg in his temple. So back to verse 18. And Jael came out to meet Sisera and said to him, "Turn aside, my lord, turn aside to me. Do not be afraid." So she sees him coming, and she takes the initiative and goes out to meet him. Notice there's no mention of her husband, other than that she's the wife of him. Don't know anything about him, really. He's not there. Seems strange, though, that she would run out and say, "Hey, come into my tent." Who is she anyway? Well, she's not an Israelite. She's part of the Kenites. Probably doesn't worship the Lord. And in fact, there's no mention of him in this section either. No mention of the Lord at all. She seems to just be acting out on her own, apart from her husband, apart from the Lord. That's what she appears to be doing. So she turned aside. So he turned aside and went into her tent. And she covered him with a rug, and he said to her, "Please give me a little water to drink, for I am thirsty." So she opened a skin of milk and gave him a drink and covered him. This is probably milk that is fermented, most likely. Alcoholic. You've probably never heard about alcoholic milk. They have it in Mongolia. They have goat's milk vodka. She's probably serving him something like that. "I want to make sure he's asleep. He's exhausted. I want to make sure he's asleep." And he said to her, "Stand by the tent, the opening of the tent, and if any man comes and asks you, 'Is anyone here?' say no." So that's an okay translation. In a very, very literal translation would be really clumsy in English. But for the ironic part of this story, I'm going to translate it slightly more literally than the ESV has it here. "Stand at the opening of the tent, and if a man," not any man, "if a man comes and asks you, 'Is there a man here?'" Not "Is there anyone here?" "Is there a man here?" "Say no." And a better translation than "no" would be, "One does not exist." Sisera calls his own end. He calls himself into non-existence. But Jael, the wife of Heber, took a pent peg and took a hammer in her hand. And she went softly to him and drove the peg into his temple until it went down into the ground while he was lying fast asleep from weariness. So he died. So Daniel Block just point. This is he's great on this in this commentary and great on this point. He said we should really notice the similarity here between the story of Ehud that we had last time before this one and this one. You've got a violent assassination. The killer gets the other person, the victim, to trust him or her. The killer acts out of deception. The enemy makes himself vulnerable. And here's where it just all comes together, because it makes the same word is described at the sound of driving the peg into Sisera's skull as in when Ehud drives the dagger into Eglon's belly. Same sound is made. God uses all kinds of people to accomplish his purposes. Ehud was an Israelite. Jael is not. They both act treacherously out of deception. They both assassinate. They're sinners. The Lord uses it. He accomplishes his purpose through his own enemies. God does that, and he does that because he knows how to rescue his people. And behold, as Barak was pursuing Sisera, Jael went out to meet him and said to him, "Come, and I will show you the man whom you are seeking." She doesn't tell him he's dead. So he went into her tent, and there lay Sisera dead with the tent peg in his temple. So there they are, standing together, looking at him, one that should have had the honor if he would have had faith, and the other one who does, who probably has none. The Lord subdues Yavin before Israel. So this is the conclusion, like we had an introduction in the first three verses. In the last two, we have a conclusion, and we'll cover it very rapidly. So on that day, God subdued Yavin, the king of Canaan, before the people of Israel. And the hand of the people of Israel pressed harder and harder against Yavin, the king of Canaan, until they destroyed Yavin, the king of Canaan. So God subdued Yavin before the people of Israel. God did it, stating it out straightly. He's the one that did it. We'll find more about that in the next chapter, as I said. And the hand of the people of Israel pressed harder and harder against Yavin, the king of Canaan, until they destroyed Yavin, the king of Canaan. So, Judges, the story of how Israel becomes more and more like Canaan. And in this concluding part to this story, notice that the king of Canaan is repeated three different times. Yavin, the king of Canaan, the king of Canaan, the king of Canaan. You should get this. Don't be like the Canaanites. God knows how to rescue his people. Let's close in prayer.